This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from young people about organized religion. They appear to be going in opposite directions.
I never had that cool youth group type feel, like the youth group side of things. It's not there.
Teenager Kate Lorenz and church leaders talk about the disconnect. GLT's Judy Valente reports. Since the budget veto override, nearly two dozen staffers with Governor Rauner's office have quit or been fired. In an IPR report, hear where the governor is looking for staff and what that could mean. And it's a conversation with ISU's new women's head basketball coach. Kristen Gillespie is excited about the level of community support for the program. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's August 7th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Americans are among the world's most religious people. However, increasing numbers are among the so-called nuns, people who say they follow no particular faith tradition. Feeling that trend are those under the age of 30. The Pew Research Center says 36% of people between the ages of 18 and 24 reject organized religion. Pope Francis is trying to coax them back to the church. He's put a survey online asking young people to tell him about themselves and their spiritual needs. GLT's Judy Valente talks with local teens and young adults about their experiences with churches and pastors who are trying different ways of reaching out to young people.
It's the 5:30 p.m. Sunday Mass at Epiphany Catholic Church. This used to be the parish's Life Teen Mass, but it isn't any longer. White-haired and middle-aged people fill the pews, even some children, but there are few teens or young adults. That concerns Father Eric Powell, Epiphany's pastor.
There's a wave crashing on this generation from Australia to Europe to the United States that we're only slowly beginning to deal with.
That wave is a burgeoning trend among young people to reject organized religion, though many still say they yearn for a spiritual life. These are the so-called nuns. When asked about their religious affiliation, they say they have none. It's a trend that affects denominations across the board. The Pew Research Center says about a quarter of Americans under the age of 30 describe themselves as either atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Now Pope Francis wants to hear from young people. He's put a survey on the internet asking Catholics between the ages of 13 and 29 to tell him about themselves and what they seek from church.
That has to do with a lot of the young people that are growing just not necessarily disaffected with the faith, but part of a generation that has different priorities. And Pope Francis wants to get ahead of that, I think. Say, well, where are you at? And how can we minister to you and accompany you as young adults in a meaningful way?
Powell says he's hired several youth ministers over the years, but they soon quit. The hours are long and the pay is low. He once vowed to stop shaving until he could hire another youth minister. That resulted in a biblical-style chest-length beard for several months.
The stopping and starting with youth ministry made it hard for the kids to bond with someone and stay with it.
But the problem goes deeper. 14-year-old Joseph Dubrovic attends church because his parents want him to and because he feels the draw of the sacred. But ask him if he gets much out of it.
A lot of times it depends on if I'm tired or not, because if I'm almost dozing off, it's kind of hard to listen to what they're saying.
The average age of Catholic priests in the U.S. is now 63 compared to 35 in 1970. Dubrovic says he might not snooze during sermons if the priests delivering them were hipper.
Once they get younger priests going in and they can have fresh perspectives on the scripture that they see, then masses will become a lot more engaging.
Sometimes, you know, I'd sit there and I'd be like, wow, what is he talking about? You know, he'd be using these big words and I'm like, I'm still like 16 here.
That's Kate Lorenz talking about her experience of Sunday preaching. Lorenz is now 19 and a sophomore at Troy University in Alabama. For most of her teen years, she attended St. Patrick of Myrna Catholic Church in Bloomington.
I never had that cool youth group type feel, like the youth group side of things. It's not there.
Still, Kate says religion is, quote, huge for her. But she often skips church when she's away at school. And when she's back home, she no longer goes to the Catholic parish her family attends, but this church. Eastview Christian Church, where the sermons include videos shown on a wide screen. Electric keyboard, bass guitars, and drums pound out the worship music, and the pastor sits on a stool on a stage and preaches from notes on an iPad.
It would just be crazy right now not to have, big screens and lots of video-driven content now for a student ministry, right? Or the right kind of music that's high quality.
Mike Baker is Eastview's pastor. The church has about 5,500 members. Baker estimates about a third of them are under 30.
And so I think a lot of people miss ministry to teenagers because they keep doing the same thing that was really relevant and awesome in the 70s and 80s and 90s, but now culture has changed. And so is this constant attention to what does a teen culture look like?
Baker spent many years as a youth minister before becoming senior pastor and wrote a book called How Teens Do Church.
We don't have a pulpit. We have a stool, usually. I've got this crazy contraption I call the iPulpit. It's very low. And it's very close because we want it to be community. We want it to be conversational.
The come-as-you-are tone of the services at Eastview appeals to Kate Lorenz.
Just come sit down and just praise the Lord with us. And it doesn't matter, like, who you are, what you believe in, just, like, as long as you're developing a relationship with God. So and, I mean, that's just big with me.
Board. And the screens will come down. There's a light, lighting and fog and music, live music down there.
Eastview has two worship spaces. Both are large auditorium-type rooms. One of the worship areas has high round tables and chairs like those you might see in a cafe or club. Baker says he wants the young adult worship space to feel like Chicago's famous music club, House of Blues. He says a significant portion of his congregation members are ex-Catholics.
If you're a priest in a Catholic church, you're going to have to be comfortable with not liking some of the methods that are used and some of the ways you might do ministry in order to get across the message.
Father Powell of Epiphany Parish says he is hard-pressed to compete with Eastview's snappier liturgies.
I confess to all my life and to you, my brother.
Powell notes the Catholic Mass is bound by 2,000 years of tradition. It's essentially the same anywhere in the world. He says independent, non-denominational churches like Eastview can innovate more easily and take risks.
It's like a mini Vatican. They can be quick to adjust to the realities on the battlefield. So we're not as fleet of foot as they are, but many priests and many parishes in the Diocese of Peoria are trying to say, how do we turn the corner? How do we learn from our evangelical brothers and sisters?
Christ, have mercy.
The number of registered parishioners at Epiphany has declined more than a third in the last 14 years, from about 3,400 in 2003 to about 2,000 today. It's a pattern repeated throughout the Peoria Diocese and at many mainline Protestant churches as well.
Part of the antidote to millennials or anyone sort of wandering away is a real effort by adults, groups of many adults, to engage the kids and get to know them and befriend them, show that, hey, let's just sit down and chat.
Powell says he is trying to fight the trend with a more personal approach to pastoring.
Let's engage with one another. As one cardinal in Europe said, you got to begin with people in a familial setting. Start at the dining room table. And he goes on to say, don't start with the bedroom.
Many Catholic young adults depart from church teaching. So-called millennials, born around 2000, have only known legalized abortion. They attend schools with openly gay and transgender students. They grew up with same-sex marriage as the law of the land. What they seem to want is not pat answers, but a real sense of what it means to have a relationship with God and a sense of the sacred day-to-day. Helise Schoenig is an incoming senior at University High School in Normal.
Sometimes I wish that the answer they would give would allow us more room to grow in our faith versus such a narrow answer that it almost discourages us from even asking in the first place.
Schoenig was raised a Catholic, but often worships at Eastview. What is she hoping to find there?
It's hard to make God into a real person, to humanize that type of idea about God. And I guess that finding out all the ways that God is present in our everyday lives is something that I like to learn from church.
Pope Francis's young adult survey asks a variety of questions. Do you have a positive self-image? A positive outlook on life? How much confidence do you have in government, your school, the Catholic Church? How much do you use social media? Helise Schoenig says she paused at one question in particular.
The one that probably stood out to me the most, I would say, is who is Jesus to you? On the survey, there was a lot of different options you could click on, and I agreed with almost everyone, but I think the one that stuck out most to me was probably friend, because I like to consider Jesus my friend.
And when young adults do receive an authentic experience of faith, they are apt to remember it for a long time. 17-year-old Lauren Dubrovic recalled something a priest told her one day when she went to confession. It was a story about Mother Teresa of Calcutta, now a Catholic saint.
She used to look at other people as, what does the Christ in that person need from her? And she always worked to provide that for them. So I feel like that kind of changed my perspective on what it really meant to even be Catholic or even be Christian, because in my opinion, I'm Christian first and, you know, Catholic second. And that, I mean, that was a game changer for me, at least.
Dubrovic describes herself as a feminist, but says it doesn't bother her that Catholic women can't be priests because they hold other leadership roles in parishes.
Women can't be priests, but if you just look at the church board and you look at who's teaching religion classes and who is really socializing children in the Catholic faith, a lot of people are women.
And she sees signs of hope in the papacy of Pope Francis, that the church is moving away from politically charged social issues and focusing more on messages of mercy, forgiveness, and inclusiveness.
I feel that the Catholic Church in a lot of ways is evolving to be more based on what I would call the basics of Christianity versus focusing on little rules. So I want to be around in the Catholic Church to see that when it's fully evolved and it's, you know, it's to the point where we're more inclusive of all types of people.
Still, the church has been through a rough patch recently. A key advisor to Pope Francis, Cardinal George Pell of Australia, was forced out of his Vatican post amid accusations he moved around abusive priests and that he too is a sexual abuser. In a move that drew condemnation from LGBT groups nationwide, the Bishop of Springfield, Illinois, declared married gay people cannot receive communion in his diocese and cannot serve in parish ministries. Father Powell of Epiphany Church says pronouncements like that risk giving parishioners the sense their church lacks compassion.
Life is too messy. I mean, I deal with people living and dying and, you know, the confessional. We have confessions every day. Just the messiness of life. I couldn't imagine trying to be in a position of judging anyone or everyone that approaches me in communion.
He has a message for teens and young adults who've lost interest in the Catholic Church. Give it another chance. Joseph Dubrovic, the teen who sometimes dozes off during Mass, says he's willing to do that.
I'll probably keep some sort of Christian faith at the very least, but I think I'll probably, at least for most of my life, I doubt I'll ever stop practicing the Catholic faith.
And high school senior Helise Schoenig has a message for church leaders.
Older people in the church complain about our generation and complain about the way we are, but I think that our generation should be looked at in a positive way because we have so much more potential than people make us out to have with all the innovations and inventions that are coming up and all these things that people my age know that people who are older than me still don't even know yet.
census is likely to get a variety of views through his online survey of teens and young adults. What kinds of changes he'll make after receiving that information remains to be seen. I'm Judy Valente.
Researchers say Americans in their 20s and 30s are not returning to organized religion as they age and have children of their own, as their counterparts in the boomer generation did. Still, there is a counterpoint to this trend away from organized religion. The Pew Research Center finds that about three-quarters of American adults still belong to some religion, and those religiously affiliated adults are arguably more active and devout today than in the past. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative. Building relationships while supporting and serving the community, Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's a conversation with ISU's new women's head basketball coach. John Norton talks with Kristen Gillespie coming up during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner has vetoed a long-sought change in the way the state funds education, making districts around the state very nervous about how long they can stay open. Brian Mackey moderates this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable. Joining him to discuss the veto of SB1 is Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune, WBEZ reporter Tony Arnold, and IPR education reporter Dusty Rhodes.
His stated objection was that it does too much for Chicago. And so what he ended up doing with his amendatory veto was, hurting Chicago in every way he could think of, it appears, in ways that had not even been contemplated before.
Well, let's start with there's been a lot of discussion about pensions, right, and helping Chicago, from the Democratic standpoint, helping Chicago meet its teacher pension obligations, right? That's been drastically underfunded.
Well, Chicago's the only district that pays their own teacher pensions. All of us pay all the other teacher pensions all over the state, and that's a giant source of the inequity. It ranges from like $300 per kid to $1,400 per kid, depending on which district you're talking about. So yeah, that's part of it. But what he did was, you know, he went beyond the pensions and the Chicago Block Grant. The thing that immediately jumped out at me was the way he tackled TIFs and PTIL, and I don't want to have everyone drown in alphabet soup, but those are areas that districts cannot access the funds for, and right, wants to count that as though they could. Like, you have a secret chest of money, he thinks that you...
Yeah, no. So without getting too much into the alphabet, so TIF is a tax increment financing, right? This is, let's say you
You're
have like
going to make people drive off the road.
Well, that's all right. So let's say you have a big empty lot, right, in a part of town that maybe needs some development. The city would pass a TIF district, and then a developer could come in, put a shopping mall on that lot, and then even though it's taxed, property taxes are raised at the level of a new shopping mall. The school district only gets money as though it's an empty lot. Do I have that basically right?
It's something like that. When I asked his spokesperson why, you know, what's this obsession all of a sudden, where did the TIF and PTIL stuff come from out of the blue? She said, well, prime example is Chicago. Yeah, I remember Jeannie Ives standing up and saying this about how Chicago hides its wealth with TIFs. So this is really something that, you know, is targeted at Chicago. But the thing is, like, I called the superintendent of the second largest school district in Illinois and asked him what this does to him. And he's got $35.2 million worth of property in TIF or PTIL. He would take a hit of $2.5 million in local revenue. The thing that's really troubling is, I'm not sure anyone knows how this would shake out. Like, I'm not sure anyone has actually modeled the amendatory veto. I'm not sure the governor knows how his amendatory veto would affect the finances of each district.
Yeah, and there was a weird moment this week where the governor had a website he was directing people to. Even at the news conference where he announced the amendatory veto, Monique directed people to this website, and then you couldn't access it, and now it's going to be another week or who knows until the State Board of Ed does their assessment of this?
Correct. So in the weeks leading up to this action, the governor had been touring schools, particularly downstate, trying to say, hey, I promise that my amendatory veto will benefit you. Go to this website. Here are some mystery numbers. We're not entirely sure how they're calculated, but this will show you how your schools will benefit if I cut portions out for Chicago. So during this press conference, we're asking him to go over details of what the bill does. Governor, can you explain it to us? And he says, oh, go check the website. You try to check the website and it's password protected. You can't access it. And in the last couple of days now, they've put, I think, a disclaimer saying, oh, you'll be able to log back into this in a couple of days once ISBE runs these numbers.
Oh, newsflash. It's back up.
Oh.
But it's the same old numbers. Only now, this morning, the disclaimer says that it's Senate Bill 1124, which was Jason Barrickman's school funding proposal. I just checked, and those numbers are the same as the governor's Our Plan. I've got air quotes going, guys. Our Plan numbers, which best we could tell come from putting the APROPE in plus the $203 million he's taking out of Chicago Public Schools block grant. And if you run that through the normal thing with TIFs and PTELs still intact, those would be the numbers you would get. So those numbers, I say, take with a grain of salt.
I'd have to wonder if this website has come back up because the governor is now touring editorial boards and still directing people to that website.
They need to read the disclaimer, but the disclaimer is not even, those aren't even 1124 numbers.
All right. So, Tony, I mean, one of the bigger points here that I'm hearing is the governor's touring the state saying big bad Chicago wants to take money from your kids, right? And this is not a new message from the governor, even though he is from Chicago, at least part of his life he lived in Chicago. One of his kids famously went to a Chicago public school after he exercised some clout to get in. But this is not a new approach from him, right?
Right. And what Rauner is doing is saying, well, by my changes, this would change, take money that would be directed to Chicago Public Schools, but Rockford, you get X dollars more money than you would have otherwise if I just done nothing. Decatur, you would get X dollars more, and you can go down the list. And he's been trying to make this. He has a whole list of cities that this dollar amount that each one would be getting more of. But Democrats say this is nothing more than pitting downstate and suburbs against Chicago, and this is playing geographic politics in the worst way, pitting one student against another. And this is something that the speaker has been mentioning a lot in his statements, the same thing with the Senate president. And the reason that that's noteworthy is because they control what happens to this amendatory veto. The Senate now has, from the time of the veto, has 15 days to take action on the bill, and that sets up this showdown basically of are they going to have the votes or not to override. There's a big question in both the House and the Senate. It did not originally pass with the votes needed to override the governor's veto. So the question is, are enough people going to flip? And I imagine there's a lot of people who are feeling a lot of pressure right now to either stick to their guns and stay a no vote or flip to yes and override the governor's veto.
And it seems like there's maybe a hope among some Democrats that some of the 16 Republicans who supported across the aisle to support some part of the budget, not that many were there for the eventual override vote, but for the initial vote, there were 16 Republicans who did that. I think, I don't know, I'll ask Monique, is there a hope that the Democrats can, maybe by waiting a little longer, maybe by continuing to build public pressure on this, that they can convince some Republicans to join them? Because you will need both Democratic and Republican votes. There's not enough of any one party, at least in the House, to do something that would take immediate effect.
That obviously seems to be the goal here. It's going to be a little bit of a more difficult lift because the governor has done a lot to try to whip people back into shape in recent weeks. He's had secret meetings with whole caucuses, kind of trying to lay out what the plan is in an effort to get loyalty. And while he has tapped into this kind of time-honored regionalism, there's still a lot of questions about how downstate districts are impacted. You know, we've had the top numbers, and he's going around saying, I'm taking millions of dollars away from Chicago. But as Dusty noted, there are a lot of questions about what some of his other more technical and complicated changes mean for downstate districts. We had Senator Menard out yesterday saying, look, this is his effort to dismantle public education in Illinois, and I don't know any lawmaker who can vote in favor of this. He had a big map that showed lots of orange spaces where he says districts downstate could stand to lose money, if not immediately, in the future.
Monique Garcia reports for the Chicago Tribune. Joining her on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were IPR's Dusty Rhodes, moderator Brian Mackey, and Tony Arnold of WBEZ in Chicago, who has this next report on sound ideas. Nearly two dozen people who worked for Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner have either quit or been fired over the past several weeks. After legislators overturned his veto of a state budget, Rauner turned to the Illinois Policy Institute to replace a few of those who are gone. Arnold takes a look at the group and what it might tell us about the future of Rauner's term.
The Illinois Policy Institute has been labeled a lot of things: conservative, libertarian, far right wing, and it has any number of critics at the state house, like State Representative Sarah Feigenholz, a Chicago Democrat.
You'll see that they are nothing more than a bunch of extremist views, inappropriate for governing in this state.
But in fact, some former employees of the Policy Institute are now governing the state. Rauner has a new policy director, communications director, and chief of staff who come from the group. The chief of staff, Christina Rasmussen, was not immediately available for an interview, but the CEO of the Policy Institute, John Tillman, says all those adjectives used to characterize the group are wrong.
People use labels all the time, conservative, libertarian, that sort of thing. We don't think those are actually accurate. We are really trying to just restore representative government.
The group's been around for about 15 years, and Tillman says it has agreed with Democrats on things like charter school expansion or criminal justice issues. But it's also taken hard-line stances against unions, and it fought against raising the personal income tax rate from 3.75% to 4.95%.
Is 3.75% the right tax rate, do you think?
No, I think zero would be better.
Tillman says a few other states don't collect any taxes based on income and can still fund a government with lower property taxes than Illinois has. Tillman says the group is nonpartisan, but if you spend a minute on the website, you'll see countless caricatures of Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan. That's because the Policy Institute has a whole page of editorial cartoons, because to call it a think tank is just the beginning of what Tillman's group does.
Many blame Illinois' notorious political machine for the crisis. But what exactly is the machine? And who runs it?
That's a clip from a documentary produced by the Policy Institute, critical of House Speaker Michael Madigan. Staff regularly have newspaper columns printed. There's radio broadcasts, a lobbying arm to help draft and advocate for legislation, and a legal arm to challenge state laws in court. Tillman says the goal is to look at what surrounding states are doing to shrink government or lower taxes or cut business regulations, and it tries to bring those ideas to Illinois.
None of those states are perfect, but they're doing a lot of the kind of things we're talking about well, from pension reform to tax and spending policy, regulatory reform, and all the rest of it.
But when it comes to implementing those policies, Tillman says Rauner makes his own decisions, and the governor's new staff won't change that.
Some of the staff that have gone over there have been critical of the governor. This is a guy who likes to hear different opinions. He doesn't want a bunch of sycophants around him.
Rauner himself has downplayed the staff shakeup. Here he is talking with reporters Friday.
I don't care about partisanship, and nobody tells me what my policies are. Nobody.
Tillman says it's not Rauner's policies that he expects to see change with the new staff. It's messaging. Tillman says people can expect to see a more aggressive and proactive effort to get the governor's message out. And that's something the Policy Institute does know about. During the budget battle, it encouraged Facebook followers to contact Republicans thinking of voting yes on the tax increase. State Representative Steve Anderson from West Suburban Geneva says his personal cell phone lit up nonstop for a day or two with calls.
They were very much directly
attacking me personally and professionally.
Anderson says he got death threats, and he blames the Policy Institute for those calls to his cell phone. He says he won't work with them again on legislation. The Policy Institute denies connecting its followers to Anderson's cell phone and says it doesn't condone that or making threats. But regardless of that, Anderson says what the Policy Institute wanted out of the impasse, severe cuts to government, was never going to have the votes. And he says the people who advocated for that unrealistic proposal are the ones Rauner has now hired.
These are people that, to my knowledge, have never governed. So they've been in think tanks and they've done a lot of thinking. But there is a difference between a think tank and actually govern.
Still, some other Republicans think Rauner's hires from the Policy Institute are cause for optimism. Here's State Representative Jeannie Ives from Wheaton.
I expect to see actually a much stronger focus on policy and what's the right policy for Illinoisans, regardless of party affiliation.
Another Republican state representative, Tom Morrison from Palatine, says he does not expect the new hires to change Rauner's policies, but the new staff should help Rauner spread his message in ways that Morrison says the news media either can't or won't. I'm Tony Arnold.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Months into her tenure as the Illinois State women's head basketball coach, Kristen Gillespie has been a whirling dervish. She's been scouring the Midwest, recruiting talented high school and junior college players. On campus, she's still becoming acquainted with the personalities and abilities of the players she inherited. And she's learning the quirks of a brand new town and university. She stopped by for a breather with GLT's John Norton to talk about her new position at ISU. She says the move from her previous coaching job at Division II Lewis College in Romeoville, Illinois, is more than just a step up the coaching ladder.
I think it's just a great job. When you look at women's basketball jobs in the state of Illinois, I think this is a elite level. You know, we have unbelievable support from President Dietz down, great community support, and I think that's what separates Illinois State from some of the other universities in Illinois, is that unique community backing. You know, people really have a vested interest in women's basketball. I know the past couple of years, the product may not have been where it once was, but I think if you can put a better product on the floor, I think it creates a lot of excitement and a great atmosphere that will attract really good recruits.
When you came here, or when you saw tape or whatever, what did you see?
From a basketball standpoint?
From a basketball standpoint and from an attitude standpoint, maybe.
You know, I think they're, you know, we've really worked since I got here mid-April of changing the culture of our program. You know, I think sometimes when a group doesn't have a lot of success, that becomes kind of the standard, you know. So we're really trying to raise expectations just of work ethic, habits, you know, what is being demanded, whether it's from a academic standpoint or a training standpoint. You know, we just know that if things are going to change, it is going to change with the group we have right now. Yes, we are going to bring in recruits, but it has to change immediately with the young women on our team.
So you're about, what, 4 or 5 months in now?
About 4 months. It feels like about 4 days. It's gone by really. We were just talking. I can't believe it's already August. The time has flown by. I've enjoyed every minute of it. It's just sometimes you wish time would slow down, that you'd have a little bit more time.
Well, compared to then, you hinted that players might have been a little bit down 4 or 5 months ago, and they had a certain kind of attitude over the last 3 years that expectations aren't maybe what they should have been, or they feed into that after a while. What is it now, 4 months later?
You know, I think they understand what it's going to take to kind of change the ship. You know, our staff really tries to approach every day with a tremendous amount of passion and enthusiasm. And I think that becomes contagious. You know, I've seen a shift just in the overall, you know, attitude and effort level. But I think it starts from the top down, that every single day you know, it is our staff's responsibility to kind of set that tone so they can follow our lead. And you've definitely, you know, I know as a head coach, I have seen a change in just a lot of those behaviors. Now, are we where we need to be? No, but I'm hoping by, you know, November 11th, that first game, we'll have even taken bigger strides.
Is that, I mean, you've played Division I basketball. You were an assistant coach for Division I basketball, so this isn't totally new territory for you. But as a head coach, has there been any challenges that you have run into already coming up from Division II?
No, not at all. Nothing. I think, you know, coaching is coaching. It's about motivating your players. It's about building relationships. That's really big with our program. So, you know, I don't think it matters what level you are. It comes down to can you teach the game? Can you relate to your players? Can you attract better talent into your program? And I was really fortunate. I hired a great staff, and they've done a tremendous job these past couple of months of doing those three key things.
As a Division I coach, you have access to better players, I would think, than, you know, Lewis is a good program, but still.
Yes, it's been very enjoyable watching the best of the best this summer, you know, of the AAU games. We just got off the road. We were on the road for about 20 days this summer. Recruiting is going really well. You know, we have two commitments already. We're trying to wrap up the 2018 class in the next month. And, you know, we're bringing in players that will play immediately and impact our program.
Well, what is the perception of parents, coaches on the AAU or even high school and the kids themselves? What's their impression of Illinois State women's basketball right now?
You know, they know that we're in a rebuilding process, but it's amazing that it's such a well-known school. Everyone that we've really focused on the Midwest, you know, just the surrounding states, Illinois. Everyone knows someone that went to Illinois State, or they have a friend from school, so they hear really positive things just about the overall, you know, college life here. Once we get them to campus, they are blown away just how, number one, how beautiful campus is, the support we have. Everyone you run into, you know, kind of has the same message of just, we're here to serve our students. I think people walk away with even a better understanding, and they're really excited about the possibility at Illinois State.
If I'm reading between the lines, putting words in your mouth a little bit, the program has been down a little bit, but you're seeing a hidden jewel here.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, we've probably, in the past four months, had 25 recruits on campus. And not one recruit has ever had one bad thing. Of course, they're not going to say it to your face, but then you follow up with AU coaches or high school coaches, and it has been the consistent message of they can't believe how special of a place with the people, with our facilities, you know, that it's only a matter of time before this thing gets back going again.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Illinois State University head women's basketball coach, Kristen Gillespie. You come from a strong coaching background. I'm sure you've talked about this quite a bit. I want to go to, and maybe you've talked about the other venues as well, but Randy Reinhardt from the Pantograph had an article when you were hired asking you about the comparison between the little girl and Remember the Titans and you. And you told him you were that girl.
Oh, gosh. I just feel so bad for my mother.
Are you blushing right now?
Yeah, she was such a good sport putting up with me. My brother and I grew up going to every one of my father's practices. You know, I remember when I was in elementary school, my mom would pick us up from, you know, St. Mary's and take us right over to my dad's practices. I can't believe I'm saying this. I, like, ran sprints preseason. Like, I really thought I was on the team.
How old were you when you were running sprints?
Oh, like second grade. It was really embarrassing. I rode the bus. I sat on the bench. I really thought I was a part of the team. My dad's players were always so gracious and so good to me. But, you know, that was just, I was really fortunate because it was never pushed on my brother. It was just what we grew up around. And, you know, I fell in love with just the coaching aspect. You know, my grandfather was a fantastic coach. He was at one point the all-time winningest college baseball coach, you know, coached for 54 seasons. So it was just something that was always around, you know, and it was just, we were a very athletic family. It was just something that, you know, every day that was our dinnertime conversations.
You know, you made me think of something. You grew up around boys and men coaching, and the coaches themselves and the players. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference coaching men versus women?
You know, I think the way you teach the game is very similar. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes the way, you motivate is a little different. I think on the women's side, it is a little bit more relationship based.
Yeah.
You know,
I think there was an interview a number of years ago with Gino at UConn, who I think it was him. It might have been someone else who kind of said the same thing, that he would write little notes and letters to his players. He would never do that probably for a men's program, though.
No. And, you know, it's funny because one of our members of our staff happens to be my cousin, Scott Gillespie. He just came from the men's side. He was a men's Division I coach. And just listening to him compare and contrast, it is a little different. You know, you can get after him. You can push both sexes. But I think on the women's side, I think it is really important. I think our young women really value knowing that you care about them as people first. You know, if you can develop those relationships and foster them, I think, you know, with girls, I often think it is feel good, play good. With guys, I think if they play good, they feel good. So it's just kind of that balancing act.
Sure. Okay. What style of play should fans and hopefully new fans expect from the Redbirds this year?
You know, this year...
Do you have the players to pull off what you really want to do?
I don't know if we have the players to pull off what we really want to do.
Well, what do you really want to do?
You know, it's going to be... It'll be interesting this year. We're going to have to get a little creative of... You know, it's not, if you look at our stats, you know, I think stats don't lie. We're not prolific scorers. So we're going to have to generate some points, some interesting ways. But, you know, I think when fans come, they will see that we do play unselfish. You know, we're going to put a premium on valuing the ball. We're going to play defense. We're going to rebound. All the effort things, that is going to be our big push for this year, making sure that we are at the top of all the effort stats of the Missouri Valley. Now, will we lead the conference in scoring? Gosh, no. You know, it is what it is. Eventually, you know, we are going to play up-tempo. You know, with the young women we're recruiting to add into what we have now, we're going to have a really strong post game inside out, but we're going to surround them with shooters, kind of trying to spread the floor, you know, and just an exciting style that fans can come in and, you know, there'll be some, you know, three shot and made, but we also have an inside presence. It's not going to be helter-skelter, but it's going to be an up-tempo, spread the floor, and put our players in a position to be successful.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
New ISU women's head basketball coach Kristen Gillespie speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Redbirds play an exhibition game in Redbird Arena November 1st against Eureka College before officially opening the season with a road game at Oakland in Rochester, Michigan. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Support for GLT comes from Heil Group, a registered bike-friendly business. Bloomington Normal and Heil Group support bicycle commuting, asking bikes to follow rules of the road and drivers to share the road, so we all arrive home safely after every commute. Heil Group information at heilgroup.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A pair of Twin Cities artists have moved into a new space they hope not only sparks their own creativity, but offers a space for other artists to show their works. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
For a number of years, artist Jan Brandt ran a gallery out of the old Coca-Cola plant in Bloomington. But after a while, that location kind of lost its fizz. So she pulled up stakes and paints and fabrics and ink and grabbed a new partner in art to establish a new studio and gallery space. Now Brandt shares exhibition and creative space with fellow artist Jeannie Breitweiser. And Brandt says they're keen to share.
So it'll be two different artists working in one space that is divided, and we will collaborate on some things, and we already, you know, we bounce ideas off each other. We've been friends for a long time, yep. So, you know, it's just great. This way we get to split expenses, and we have a lot of the same friends, but we also get to meet each other's friends and contacts. We're just thrilled.
Where were you before, Jeannie?
Right next door. We were right next door to each other.
In the Coca-Cola plant.
And, we just got to build our friendship more and more, and as things change, why we got closer and just shared a lot of the same ideas and stuff like that. So she's a good mentor for me.
How do you feel about that?
That means a lot to me. I just constantly am sort of brainstorming out loud. So Jeannie actually, it doesn't seem to bother her that it inspires her, you know, makes it easier for to get along. It might bug other people, but
no,
she's an inspiration to me also because she's been involved in propping for plays for years in our community and has done so much great work in the Bloomington Normal Theater group. So,
well, let's talk about your different styles. Now, what type of artwork do you create, Jan?
I vary. I'm a mixed media artist. I'm a printmaker. That's when I went back to school, I concentrated in printmaking, but I also like to push the envelope in my artwork, and I also do painting, but I've also, over the last couple of years, have enjoyed a lot of success doing textile installations. They're sort of biomorphic and they're recycled materials, and I called them like Happy Contagion or Biolab, and I've shown them probably about 10 times. Recently in town, it was at Heartland at the Joe McCauley Gallery, and through social media, it was picked up by the Illinois State Museum. And it's currently in an exhibit called Toy Box at the State Museum in Lockport. So that was big for me, starting later in my life, being an artist, that I'm in a museum.
And she's been in many art magazines, too, for all of her new latest things that she's been doing. So
I think it's different enough, the textile pieces, that they're getting noticed. And so I still have a love for painting and printmaking. I always will. But kind of branching out into this it's people notice it. It's different, I guess. Oh, and clothes.
That's what I was going to say. Her designs have been, this is just amazing. She has pillows, leggings, tennis shoes, iPhone covers, backpacks, athletic clothes.
Tell me about what you create, Jeannie.
Yes. I am also mixed media. I love collecting vintage pieces of toys and wood and jewelry and antique knobs and things like that. And I make assemblages, collages with those items. I take them all apart and use torn paper and oil pastels and drawing and all that sort of thing. Most of my time's been spent doing propping for plays locally, which I'm the most proud of.
So do you guys see yourself as artists sharing creation space, as sparking off of one another with creativity?
Definitely. It's nice to come to a place and if I see your car here, it's like, oh, great, and it isn't lonely. You know, we can stay on task, but we can also just have a good time, and that's important, I think.
We can yell at each other.
Right.
What do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Right.
So it's been very exciting, and we're really very happy.
But it's not just a place for creating. It's also a place for showing what others have created. It's still a gallery space. And right now you have something up that involves an installation of wood and rope. And tell me what's going on here, Jan.
This is called Burn Pile, and it is a collaborative installation by Peoria area artist Heather Brammeyer and Jessica Bingham. And they came in. It was a 2 days after I had started moving in, and I thought this was a perfect thing as I'm unpacking boxes to have this sort of chaotic at first when they were bringing it in, but it turned out to be perfect. Yeah, it's a smaller scale of a gallery, but this is very manageable. I was talking to my husband about it. I said it's sort of like holiday fun size bars, It's a snack and they're good and you want to come back for more. So, it's manageable for me because at the other place I'd gone through, probably 900 artists had been through there with group shows and everything. And sometimes I had three shows at a time. And with me wanting to also work on my own work, I felt that it was time to have a change in mission for me, but still be connected. I still want to be supportive.
Let's talk about this location. You're on Morrissey.
Yes.
And you're very close to Veterans Parkway.
Yes.
Do you feel like this is going to give you more visibility than you had in the old Coca-Cola plant?
I think so. It's a unique building. It's a cute little, almost looks like a house.
It does.
And we've put lots of flowers out to cheer it up, and we're going to get a sign out pretty soon. And
there's parking, which is always nice.
Very nice handicap space and very accessible.
I feel that there's some sort of psychological feeling that if people drive by, they know we're just right here. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to go into a building and try to find us or whatever. It's just like they can just come to the front door.
And we're going to maybe, seriously talking about doing some children's art classes.
Yeah.
And even maybe adult art classes. We've had some people ask about that. So mm-hmm. that's in the future. Mm-hmm. Not too long. But
we want to get art into people's lives and non-judgmental, just working hard and putting a lot of passion into it and love for it. So together, I think we're going to be very successful at that. I feel good about it.
That's Jan Brandt and Jeannie Breitweiser. The new Jan Brandt Gallery is at 1305 Morrissey Drive in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Find past editions of the GLT Datebook at our website, wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast, along with the individual stories and interviews you heard today, thanks to Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and John Norton. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Email us at news@wglt.org, post at facebook.com/wglt-fm, or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's public media.